and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the task ahead for Hillary Clinton in her speech tonight to overcome the lack of trust factor while reaching out to middle America, at the same time not alienating the Bernie or bust delegates who are poised to make a scene and perhaps walk out on her. Simon Rosenberg, the president and founder of the New Democratic Network and a former member of the 1992 Clinton War Room, joins us to discuss the tough acts that Hillary has to follow after the soaring rhetoric of the Obamas and others at the Democratic Convention who have spoken on her behalf. We'll also examine the disadvantage of being a status quo politician in this year of the outsider and whether making history as the first woman running for president as the nominee of a major party will prove to be an advantage. Then we will speak with George Lakoff, a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of The All-New Don't Think of an Elephant. We will discuss how important framing and semantics are in politics and whether the messages coming from the Clinton campaign so far are more about making her supporters feel good about themselves by reminding them how bad Trump is, rather than reaching out to those who do not support her by addressing the issues that concern them, which will not be assuaged by a rosy view of an economy that many feel has left them behind. Then finally, we'll look into the accusations of Russian hacking and apparent attempts to interfere with our elections with Robert Morgus, a policy analyst at the New America Foundation Cybersecurity Initiative. He joins us to discuss where the investigation by U.S. intelligence agency stands into the possible role of Russia's FSB and GRU intelligence organizations in the hacks of the DNC, the Clinton Foundation, and Hillary Clinton's server, which Donald Trump has encouraged the Russians to hack into to find 33,000 of her emails. And joining us now is Simon Rosenberg, the president and founder of the New Democratic Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News for 5 years before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. Welcome to Background Briefing, Simon Rosenberg.
Good to be here, Ian. And what a great show, by the way. I may have to listen to the whole thing.
Well, you can catch it at ianmasters.com in about an hour. Simon, what's your sense, though, of the task ahead tonight? Hillary Clinton is not anywhere in the same league, rhetorically speaking, as President Obama and even Michelle Obama. And there's been some pretty impressive speeches so far at this Democratic convention. So, given that disadvantage, if you will, and the other task at hand that I mentioned in the opening, how do you think she's going to reach that high bar?
Well, first of all, she's got a great team behind her. As you said, this has been a terrific week. You know, I've been in the hall the first three nights in Philadelphia, and I, particularly last night, I thought was really... This is my eighth convention and eighth Democratic convention. I think this was probably the single best night that I've ever attended in all the conventions I've been to. And I would put Michelle Obama's speech Monday night up there with the best political speeches that I've ever heard. And so, first of all, there's a lot of momentum for her, right? There's, you know, the rest of the team is doing their part. And in some ways it means to me, and I have a slightly different take perhaps than others, that it means that she perhaps doesn't have to hit the ball out of the park all the way, right? She's just got to be a strong component of this broader team. And so I think the subject matter, though, is going to be about tying these values we've heard so much about, her commitment to make people's lives better, to the current challenges that we face, and laying out a positive agenda for where she's going to take the country. I think that's what you're going to see her try to do at sort of a tactical level. And we'll see how the performance is. I mean, you're right. She's admitted herself, she is not at the upper end of the game when it comes to speech, you know, to making speeches. But I think also that's baked into the cake. People know that about her already. She's just got to do a good job. And I think that we'll come out of this convention with the kind of momentum that we need to win in the fall.
But how do you explain, though, Simon Rosenberg, that Trump is ahead in the polls after what most observers thought was one of the most depressing, dark, and paranoid closing speeches. The impression I was left with is, my God, I can't walk out on the streets. I'm going to be raped or murdered by a Mexican or blown up by a Muslim. I mean, but that gave him a bounce, apparently, and he's two points ahead of her. And all we ever hear about him is how dreadful he is. And now we hear that he's sort of consorting with the enemy. And yet he's ahead in the polls. So there's something going on here.
Well, first of all, let me explain about polling. And I've done a lot of polling myself, and I've worked on presidential campaigns. If Donald Trump had got hit by a bus, he would still end up with 45 or 46% of the vote, no matter what happens. It's sort of the rock bed for the Republican vote. And going into his convention, he was at 40%, right? He was below where a normal candidate would be. So it was inevitable that over these few weeks, he was going to go back up to 45, 46%. And that's what's happening right now. He's moving and consolidating what is the rock bed of the Republican vote. What's important for the Democrats, and I don't really worry about where the polls are today. Some polls have it even. Hillary's even up in a couple polls, right? I know the average has got it, you know, negative now or positive for Trump. Is that Hillary, I think, will get a 4 to 5 point bounce out of this week the way that Trump did, will reassert her lead, right, up to 2, 3, 4 points. And then it comes down to how the two teams execute the rest of the way and how they perform. We have more money. We've got a more sophisticated campaign. We've made super smart investments. We've won in these states before. We've won, you know, 5 out of the 6 last elections. We've won more votes than the Republicans have. We know how the game works. And I do think on some level, on this issue about, you know, Trump has virtually no campaign. He's essentially press conferences and a Twitter feed, right? And my own view about Trump is that he's been so erratic this last week since he won the nomination. Whether it's nerves, whether it's part of a strategy, you're going to talk to George Lakoff about some of this, right? Is that I think that there's signs that he's cracking a little bit and that he's starting to make mistakes. And they've had to walk back a series of things. And I think, I don't think this is the normal stuff we saw in the primaries. I think this is more grave and more serious because I think the media is taking him more seriously now. I think there's a higher bar for him. And so, you know, he's been very quiet today. He screwed up in a big way yesterday on this Russia stuff. And he has been very, very subdued today in his public comments. He's been off of Twitter for most of the day, not all of it, right? So I think that I'm still feel very confident about this race. My final point is, I went on for a long time. Tim Kaine was a great pick. I'm a big fan. I can talk about it. I know the senator personally very well. He is absolutely one of the best people that I have ever met in politics in my 25 years in national Democratic politics. He's going to be a great asset to the ticket.
And again, I'm speaking with Simon Rosenberg, who's the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News for 5 years before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. So in terms of Tim Kaine, who, by the way, a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters are extremely disappointed with and consider him a centrist or even a right winger because he supposedly supported TPP and some banking deregulation. But the impression that he does give is of somebody that with a strong moral core and a fairly obvious kind of decency. I don't know him like you do, but that's the impression I got, that he was a very decent guy who not just talked the talk, but walked the walk in terms of service to others in the way that so many Christians who pretend to be Christians don't actually follow the teaching of Jesus Christ. He seems to be the real thing in that regard. But this gets down, I know it's a long preface, this gets down to the real question, Simon. Is love going to win over hate in this election? Which is the stronger emotion in America today and particularly in October and November of this year?
It's a great question. And your in your introduction, I know you're going to be talking to George about this a little bit, is that I have a slightly contrarian view about the state of the American electorate right now. It's perhaps more in sync with the way that you heard the president speak last night. I don't think the American public is angry right now. I think that there is a portion of the electorate that's angry, the conservative, you know, the folks that voted for Trump in the primary, which is somewhere between 25 and 30% of the overall electorate. I think the rest of the electorate is, in some degree, is anxious. And there are a lot of people who are actually content and happy with the way things are in America today. I mean, Pew just did a poll where 49% of African Americans are content and happy and satisfied with the direction of the United States, 47% of Hispanics. There's economic data showing that people feel real progress. We've had rising wages in the United States for at least since 2013, maybe 2011, depending on how you cut the data. It's my own view that for a lot of people, they feel that in their own lives, things are getting better. They're not where they want them to be, and a lot of people did have substantial loss right during the Great Recession. But 20 million people have health insurance that didn't have it before, pre-existing conditions, all the things that we could go through, right, the president talked about last night. The president's approval rating is up in the 50s. The approval rating for him on economic issues is in the high 40s. And so what I believe where we are is that I think the conditions are set for Democrats to win a status quo election, right? That things are, there is a clear sense that things are improving, but fragile, and that Trump represents a threat to the progress that's being made. I don't think that's a hard argument to make, right? Because I think it's manifestly true. And I also think we're not getting ahead of the data. We're not getting ahead of our voters. But to argue that things haven't improved, that wages haven't gone up, the deficit hasn't gone way down, that we haven't had tens of millions of people gain health insurance that didn't have it before, I mean, those things are not true, right? I mean, and Trump's argument, the dystopian future, the dystopian America that he talks about, isn't here. It's not the country that we are living in today, right? I mean, one of my favorite things that he says that is the most, you know, is I think so false, because of the inner city and the dangerous inner cities. I don't know what country he's been living in, but when I was growing up in the United States, urban areas were dangerous, right? I mean, the crime rate is way down in the United States. We're seeing incredible revitalization of virtually every city in the United States with incredible building and restaurants, people coming back, people moving back in the cities. We are going through, I think, a really important period of growth and modernization in the United States. Can things get better? Absolutely. So I'm not as concerned as others that we have to turn this in, that we have to have change versus change. I think Hillary Clinton, despite Bill Clinton's change maker argument, I think is going to be very hard to sell as a change candidate. And I think that what we have to do is, I think, go where they're going tonight, which is, you know, she's heavily experienced. She knows what she's doing. It's a dangerous time. You want her finger on the nuclear button and not that crazy guy down the street, right? And I think that all things being equal, we can sell what we've done. Here's my final point of this. And I think what Obama did last night was really important. If people don't believe that Barack Obama left the country better than he found it, then there is no reason to vote for us, or at least the reasons are more tenuous than they would be. It is really important that the Democrats make the strongest case they can that we're in better shape today than when Barack Obama came into office. If we elect Hillary, they'll get better still. If we elect Donald Trump, we will go backwards, right? I think we can win on that narrative, and it's a narrative that is consistent with who Hillary is. And so I feel good about where we are. I'm not nervous about where we are. I think we're going to go into this thing ahead in a few weeks. We've got a great team. Hillary's a very experienced candidate. And finally, I've been very impressed. I know all the Clinton team, right? They are not making mistakes. You know, and I've been a Little League baseball coach for 10 years, and I always say the team that makes the fewest mistakes wins. We are not making big mistakes in this race. These guys are running. This convention has been excellent, right? We're producing good media. We're raising lots of money. We're executing really well. And I hope that Democrats feel lift and momentum coming out of the
convention. Sure. And, of course, the ratings bear that out. And but apparently Hillary Clinton is going to declare a moment of reckoning for America tonight. She's going to be introduced by her daughter, Chelsea. But prior to that, we'll have performances by Carole King and Katy Perry. And basically, it's a question of whether or not they'll – at least one of the things, of course, given what happened to Leon Panetta, is there's a concern about the Bernie or Bus people walking out or booing. So I don't know what you can do to prevent that if it's going to happen. But when you talk about the everything's looking better in America, it's not looking better for the core voters who came out for Bernie Sanders, and that is the young people. They're indentured with student debt. Their job prospects are not good. There's a lot of boomerang kids that have gone back to move back at, back into their home. And this is something that I don't think, unless you address this, first of all, it's so illogical. The kids that Bernie brought out are the future of politics for the Democratic Party, if the party can hold them and if these kids can get into the party and make a difference. Already they're pretty disgusted by the DNC revelations, et cetera. So, you know, the last thing you want is them running off to Jill Stein. Yeah, my theory has always been that, you know, if the Republican lunatic fringe, the Tea Party, can take over the Republican Party, there's no reason why young progressives can't take over the Democratic Party.
Yeah, listen, what you just raised, we don't have enough time to bear out, right, because you put a lot on the table there, and I know you've got tremendous guests, so I'll just do this very briefly. I agree with virtually everything you just said, right? I mean, this is a challenge more than something that's resolved. Clearly, there was a massive rejection by millennials of the establishment Democratic Party in this primary. It's a serious issue. Have we done enough as a party in the reconciliation with Bernie? Have we built a party that's more connected to millennials than before? I think this is a question, and it's unanswered. Right? I don't think we've done enough. I do think, though, let's be fair, that the reconciliation with Bernie that's happened over the last few weeks has been masterful. Right? I think the Clinton campaign gave, you know, Bernie had significant wins on the platform. He just won this big superdelegate fight where we basically disabled two-thirds of the superdelegates are going to have to vote now with their state and won't have the independence of going their own way. That's a massive reform of the Democratic Party. So I think that part of the reason that Bernie himself is so on board right now is that he feels the Clinton folks respected him and his people. And what we're going to need from him is not just a speech, but from him to continue to campaign with Jane. I mean, Jane Sanders said last night that she and Bernie are going to be vigorously campaigning to Hillary Clinton. So I think it's a process. I agree with you, right? It's the process. We're not there. We can't be satisfied. Hillary hasn't had the bump yet. It hasn't happened. We think it will because it's been a good convention. And then the final thing I'll say is about young people is that young people aren't angry. And if you look at, and I know that all the economic data you're citing, but when you look at issues of optimism, and future and, you know, views towards the future, young people are the most pro-trade, for example, of any demographic group in the United States. They are not with Bernie on TPP and trade, right? I mean, they're far more pro-trade than older white Americans are. And so there isn't, despite the economic struggle you're talking about, student loan debt and everything else, lack of jobs, this is not these are folks that are actually still retaining an enormous degree of optimism. And also, given how racially diverse this generation is, what you're seeing is sort of I'm going to close with this, is that for all that we've heard about the racial anxiety of older white people, there's an enormous deep satisfaction in black and Hispanics and Asian voters in the United States and a sense that progress is being made, that America is becoming more true to its word about all people being created equal, that things are getting better. 81% of Hispanics in a recent Pew poll said they expect to make more money this year than they made last year, right? And so I would argue with you that if you really do drill down on polling data and attitudinal data, the Democratic coalition, the Obama coalition, is pretty happy with where things are in the country, right? They want it to be better. They're not satisfied, but they're also not angry. There is 25-30% of the country that is deeply angry about what's going on, and all of them are going to vote for Donald Trump. And so I believe that we have a majority, and we have a majority that likes this president, that respects what he's done, that understands the Democratic Party is looking ahead and is the party of the future. And but on the Bernie stuff, right, this is a process. I think we're in far better shape today than I thought we would have been, frankly, coming into this convention. But we've got a lot of work to do to make the Bernie people in each of these districts, each of these states, feel like an important part of the future of the Democratic Party. If we don't do that, right, and that's what you're implying, Ian, right, we're going to pay a heavy price for that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Simon Rosenberg.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Simon Rosenberg, who's the president and founder of the New Democrat Network, a leading progressive think tank and advocacy organization. Previously, he was a writer and producer at ABC News for 5 years before working on the Dukakis and Clinton presidential campaigns, where he was a member of the 1992 Clinton War Room. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with George Lakoff, the author of the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is George Lakoff, a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of the Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Welling. And his latest book is the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Lakoff.
Always great to be on with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, George. And I'm looking forward to our discussion, because where our previous guest said he was looking forward to hearing what we had to say, because he thought the intro was provocative. And what I've said here in the intro is we'll discuss how important framing and semantics are in politics, and whether the messages coming from the Clinton campaign so far are more about making her supporters feel good about themselves by reminding them how bad Trump is, rather than reaching out to those who do not support her by addressing the issues that concern them, which will not be assuaged by a rosy view of an economy that many feel has left them behind. So let's start with that. Do you accept any part of that premise?
Well, first, there's a lot to say. I think I'd like to talk a little bit about Trump and conservatives first, but also about the moral issues involved here and where they are and aren't being brought up in the campaign. And because that matters. And the reason it matters is really important. Most people want to do what's right. They want to think of themselves as always doing what's right. You know, there are very few people who want to say, I'm evil and I want to hurt people all the time. That's not how people think. And that is part of who they are. It's part of their identity. So the question is, what are the moral views that people have? And what I found out 20 years ago, when I started looking at the following question, what is it that conservatives have as an understanding of how their issues fit together? So back in 1994, the issue was, you know, we want to, you know, get rid of abortion, but we also want a flat tax. So what does taxation have to do with abortion? We want to get rid of the flat tax, but they don't want environmental regulations. Well, what does that have to do with the flat tax? They want to make sure everyone can own guns. What does that have to do with environmental regulations, and so on? And they had 10 things like that in the contract with America. And, you know, I then said, look, I have the opposite views on oil. What do they have to do with me? And I couldn't answer it until I started asking why the conservatives were talking about family values all the time and what those values were. And then I realized that one of my students had handed in a homework assignment where she pointed out that we have a metaphor, a very deep metaphor in this country, of the nation as family. We have founding fathers. We send our sons and daughters to war. We have homeland security. We don't want missiles in our backyard, and on and on. And it turns out that that was a major clue, that basically we understand the nature of virtually every institution in the country in terms of two utterly different family models. And before I get into that, those two different family models, nurturing parent models and strict father models, are not absolute. And this is very important. There is what I call biconceptualism. There are, if you ask what a moderate is someone who is mostly conservative but partly progressive on a few issues, mostly progressive but partly conservative on a few issues. And there is no ideology of the moderate that all moderates share. There is no middle, basically. And this is a very important thing to understand. Most people are, you know, either strongly on one side or the other, or they are biconceptual, and a lot of people are. And we need to talk about what that means exactly. So if you are a progressive parent, what does that mean, a nurturing parent? It means you care about your child. You want to empathize with the child, want to know what the child needs. You need open communication so the child will tell you what she needs. You need to you care about the child being fulfilled in life and being able to both take care of herself and others. And you want them to be raised so that they will want other people to take care of themselves and others and be fulfilled in life, in their lives. And to be fulfilled in life, you want to make sure that they're well educated, that they are physically sound, that they're protected, and that you know, they have access to cultural life. I mean, those are obvious things in nurturing parent families. And this projects onto the idea in progressive thought. In progressive thought, you have an idea that came from the beginning of the country, that citizens care about other citizens, and they act through their government to provide public resources for everybody, for business, for private life, etc. And, you know, then it was, you know, roads and bridges and court systems and national banks and stuff. But nowadays, it's a huge number of things that we supply, like all of science, you know, basis of technology, all sorts of things like cell phones. You can't have cell phones without GPS systems, and we run the world's GPS system. I mean, this is a crucial thing about, you know, how we as a public, you know, provide things for people's freedom. But conservatives have the opposite view. They have a view of a family model which has a strict father who is the authority in the family, and you don't mess with him. And it could be a woman in many cases, but basically he assumes that he knows what's right and what's wrong. His job is to make sure that his children and his wife do what he says, because that's the right thing to do. And you know, and then if the kids don't, they get punished, and punished severely enough so that they want to avoid the punishment. And to do that, they have to not do what feels good. You've heard of feel-good liberalism. That means you haven't been brought up by a good strict father. Not do what feels good, but instead do what the strict father says. If you do that, you'll get discipline, internal discipline. You'll be able to go out in the world and earn a living. And that means if you're not earning a living, you don't have discipline, you can't be moral, and you deserve your poverty, a standard view. But there's one more thing that is really powerful about this. It's the assumption that authority and morality go together, that the most moral people, according to this view of morality, are the people who should be in charge. And in a well-ordered world, they have been in charge. And so you look at who's been in charge. So you have a view of a hierarchy, a moral hierarchy, God above man. man above nature. Nature is there for you to be in charge of, to use any way you want. The rich above the poor. Employers above employees. You know, the employers give you jobs. It's not noticed that the employees give the employers profits. So you have things of that sort, and then it goes down further. It's adults above children. So in, you know, many parts of the South, teachers can use sticks to discipline kids who talk back to them. Then you have Western culture above non-Western culture, America above other nations, and then it gets, you know, further. Women, men above women, whites above non-whites, straights above gays, Christians above non-Christians. That's the moral hierarchy. And that moral hierarchy is responsible for a huge number of pieces of legislation all over the place. That is, if those moral views are in place in people's brains and in the Congress and in the presidency and the Supreme Court, that's how the country will be run from now on. And that's what Donald Trump wants. He wants that, but it's a very peculiar place of that, and he has an interesting way to get it. Donald Trump, first of all, has a different view of the strict father version than many of the other people who run the Republican Party. So if you take a look at the religious right, the pastors, you know, don't like Donald Trump because he's not religious. But the people who belong to their religion do, because they just have normal strict father morality, and Donald Trump is an ultimate strict father. The people who are running corporations, who have laissez-faire free markets, the free marketers, have a different version of strict father morality. They say, you know, that the rich is above the poor. We're rich because we take advantage of everything we have. We earned it. We deserve it. And the poor don't deserve it, period. That's the free market version of this. Trump has another version that fits most of conservatives and most conservative voters. They're the people, you know, written about in What's the Matter with Kansas and so on. That is, the people who vote against their interests. And these are people who have strict father morality at home and in their local, perhaps in their workplace and so on. But they want to be authorities in their domain. No matter how poor they are, they want it to be that way. They want to be respected for who they are, wherever they are in life. And they believe they should do better than all the people in that hierarchy. They should do better than, you know, all the other poor people. They should do better than, you know, all of the non-white people, all the non-Christian people, better than the women, etc. That is, they believe that if that isn't happening, there's something wrong with the world. And those are the people that Donald Trump is talking to, and there are tens of millions of them. They're there, and that's how that works. But now biconceptualism comes in, because this is very important. Not everybody is all one or the other. You know, you have moderates are people who are mostly one but partly the other. You have, you know, a moderate progressive is someone who is mostly progressive but has some conservative views, perhaps on business or whatever. You have plenty of conservatives who have some progressive views on some issue or other. And these views are not just floating in air. We think with our brains. That is, these things with our neural systems, which go out through our body, these ideas are there physically in our neural systems. And what that means is that you have a very complex neural circuit for each of these, but they contradict each other. How is that possible in a single brain? Because of a very simple fact about the brain. There are a lot of circuits that contradict each other, like when you do two different things that you can't do at once, for example. They are related by mutual inhibition. The activation of one inhibits the other. Now, if one of them gets stronger and stronger, the other gets weaker. And that's very important in politics. Now, what happens then is that language activates a moral system. It can activate a conservative system or a progressive system. That's a very important thing to know. And the next thing to know is don't think of an elephant. That is, if you use somebody else's language, say conservative language, just to deny it, to argue against it, you're helping them. Because if you don't think of an elephant, people will think of an elephant. So this is a very important thing to understand about how brains work. And this is very, very important to understand first who's supporting Trump and why. Now, I'll stop there for a minute, but I want to go on shortly because one of the major things you need to know is what are the tricks that Donald Trump uses as a super salesman and con man to get you to use your own brain against you. But we'll go into that in a while.
Well, let's just wrap up, though, how you started out, George Lakoff, by saying that there's a moral dimension that we should look at and that nobody says, I want to be evil. And if you've watched the Democratic Convention, there are signs all over the place saying, love trumps hate. So are you saying that love is going to win out over hate in November?
I'm saying that depends upon what is done between now and then. So let me go on, because it's very important to understand this. So one of the arguments that you get the progressives have is that Trump hasn't given us any policies. He hasn't said how he's going to do things. To any strong conservative, that is completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter, and here's why. The Republicans have thousands of policies ready to go if Trump gets elected. You know, if he gets the Supreme Court in and he has Congress, they're ready to go. It doesn't matter. As long as the nation is committed to strict father values, you know, eventually they'll all, you know, all the policies will come out. So the argument that he hasn't shown how he would do things won't matter there, because what's important to them is that the country is run in this way in general. Right? That's the big deal. And so those arguments are not going to weigh in general with Trump supporters. You know, they're not going to work. So that's the first thing to understand. This is a typical liberal argument. You know, we're going to educate people just by telling them that Trump has no policies to deal with that. You know, won't work. However, there are things that can work and that are important. And there you have to understand first how the brain works and what Trump does. First, he uses repetition. Why? Because when you have repetition of language, the language activates those moral systems, that is, the circuits in your brain. And the more a brain circuit is activated, the stronger it gets. And the stronger it gets, the easier it is for it to fire, and the more probable it is that it will fire in certain cases. What that means is that the more you repeat something, the more likely is people will think about it that way. So when you repeat Crooked Hillary and you frame, the second part is framing things. Framing is a circuit of a certain kind. So, for example, first they'll say, we're going to win, where the assumption is winners are the good people who merit it and losers deserve to lose, right? That's personal responsibility. Then he'll go and say, Crooked Hillary, which is framing Hillary as crooked. Well, the conservatives have been doing this for 25 years, and the Democrats have yet to really respond in any meaningful way, not by negating it, saying, oh, no, if you say she's not crooked, that's the same as saying she is. You know, the main thing is that you have to be able to show that she's an honorable person and a trustworthy person, and they should have been doing this for 25 years. They haven't known how to do this or even tried seriously. So that's a very serious issue. The reason that people worry about Hillary's trust is simply for 25 years, people have been activating a brain circuit that says you can't trust this person. And it's been said over and over, not evidence given, but simply the same thing. So you have cases like that. Then you have another part of this. There's a common metaphor that immorality is illegality, that is illegal. And that's why you get lock her up, She committed treason. Send her before a firing squad, etc. All right? So you have a metaphor together with all of that stuff. And what's interesting is all the attempts to show that, you know, she's done illegal things. The FBI couldn't find anything illegal about what she'd done. The Benghazi committee, for all of its huge number of hours of testimony, couldn't find anything illegal that she had done, and they buried the report. So, I mean, it's interesting to see how this is working and how the framing and repetition work. Then Trump uses another common technique, what are called well-known examples or salient exemplars in the trade. Here's how it goes. Way back in the 70s, there was a famous incident where a DC-10 crashed because on taking off, the pilot made an error in a windstorm and the wings fell off and there was a big crash. It turned out the DC-10 was the safest plane in the sky at the time. But people stopped flying DC-10s. Why? Because that picture was very dramatic and was repeated over and over and over on TV. When something like that is repeated, the neural circuits for it get stronger and stronger and stronger, which means it's more probable that they will fire. You mentioned DC-10s, and that picture is going to fire, and people will think, oh, that could happen to me. This happens all the time. So if you have a case where there is a Latino who murders someone, in San Francisco there was a case where a young woman was shot to death by someone who was a Latino felon. He just says, oh, you know, it's very well known. He'll be repeated. They'll repeat the name, et cetera, repeat, repeat, repeat. And what that does is say that Latinos in general are going to do this. That is, the probability is raised for people. And they'll say, oh, this could happen to me. The same thing is true when you have, murders committed by ISIS-inspired people who happen to be Muslim. And you have cases where there are Muslims here, and then you'll get, he'll just say, the Muslims did this, the Muslims did that. He'll name, the San Bernardino, and he'll, name other places and so on. And then you get the inference that, in general, it's highly probable that Muslims will do it to you, and you've got to ban all Muslims. I mean, this is what's behind all of that reasoning, and it's stuff that is normal in the brain. He's using your own brain against you, and that's very important. He also uses grammar against you, even grammar. So when he says, radical, Islamic terrorism, the president won't even say radical Islamic terrorism. Well, there's a reason for this. When you say radical, you are setting up a linear scale of bad things, things that are not normal and that are outside of normal practice. Secondly, when you say terrorist, and you put an adjective like Islamic before it, what it says is that there's an Islamic terrorists are high on this radical scale and therefore bad people. The grammar itself says that Muslims are bad people and likely terrorists. If you had took, for example, the Charleston murderer, who was a right-wing Republican, and you said radical Republican terrorists, it would have that influence. You'd say you got to watch out for those Republicans, And this is something that is part of the grammar of the language, and the grammar of the language is unconsciously there in your brain. And this is another very important thing. Most thought is unconscious. Some people say, some neuroscientists say it's as much as 98%, but whether it's 98% or a little bit less, it's huge. Most of your thought is beyond consciousness. You do not control it. It's in your neural system. Consciousness is a very important part of thought, but it's not, something that is just there most of the time. And so what Trump is doing is appealing to normal, unconscious thought. And that's very important.
Well, George, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I feel like we need to do a follow-up here. Can we do something soon to get the we have another subject we're about to cover.
Sure.
And I feel like there's a lot left unsaid. So let's talk soon, I hope, okay?
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you so much. And again, I've been speaking with George Lakoff. He's a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic. And his latest book is The All-New Don't Think of an Elephant. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into what the U.S. intelligence agencies are doing in terms of their investigation into Russian hacking. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Morgus, who's a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Cybersecurity Initiative, where his work focuses on the crisis crisis management, international relations, and cyber risk and insurance. And in the past, he's authored reports on sanctions and export controls, internet freedom, and internet governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Morgus.
Hey, Ian. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Robert. And what's your sense of I know there's an intelligence agency or the various alphabet soups in Washington are working and looking into the DNC hack and the alleged Russian fingerprints on it. I believe the FBI is the lead agency in that investigation. But surely the NSA, probably they already know who did it, don't they? I mean, how much do you think they're going to be involved in any kind of investigation, given that they're kind of skittish about anybody knowing about their capabilities?
I mean, according to the most recent presidential policy directive, PPD 41, which outlines the different competencies of the different agencies within the federal government when it comes to incident response in cybersecurity, the FBI is technically taking lead here. Now, that said, a lot of the capability that we're talking about when it comes to technical capability to track packets as they traverse the internet is still going to reside within the National Security Administration as well as Cyber Command. So I think we can say with reasonable certainty that both the FBI and the NSA are working on attribution here. And given the anonymous leaks that have come out of the administration in the past few days that suggest that indeed Russians, now whether that means the Russian state or agents acting on behalf of the Russian state or vigilantes in Russia are behind the hack, is sort of one of the questions that we're still seeking to answer.
So when these leaks suggest, at least some of them suggest, that the Russian hackers who broke into the Democratic Party's computers deliberately left digital fingerprints behind to show them that Moscow, show the world, I guess, that Moscow is a cyber power. And basically it's like, you know, F you, and we're Russian, and and we don't care that you know we're doing this. That sounds more like a non-state actor, like perhaps a bunch of hackers hired by the FSB or the GRU. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, so the Russian playbook in this case, and by playbook I mean sort of the tactics that the Russian government and groups close to the Russian government use, sort of suggests that this is the type of thing that they would do. They're very good at controlling narrative. They're very good at deflecting the narrative and shaping it in the way that they would like the rest of the world to see it. And we saw it with Guccifer 2, for example, where for a long period of time, popular media, whether sourced out of Russia or sourced out of the U.S., was relatively convinced that this was a Romanian hacker sort of copycatting Guccifer 1. And what we have seen once the experts sort of got a hold of the code, did a little bit of vetting of the personality behind Guccifer 2, is that this was in fact, well, not in fact, but in all likelihood, an agent of Russian influence, whether that's the Russian state directly or whether it's a proxy or a patriotic hacker in Russia working on behalf of the Russian state, is both sort of inconsequential at this point because it's working in it being he, she is working in sort of the working for the Russian state in a way that, or working for Russian strategic interests in a way that it doesn't really matter whether it's directed from on high in Moscow or whether it's an oligarch that is providing some money for an independent hacker to take some control here.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Morgus, who's a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Cybersecurity Initiative. So it's pretty hard to understand then. Obviously, Donald Trump is actually helping the Democrats by, I think, his remarks encouraging a hostile foreign power to hack into Hillary Clinton's emails. But it doesn't sound like Putin would be this reckless to tip his hand and influence an American election so covertly. We know it's no secret that he doesn't like Hillary Clinton and that they've got off on the wrong foot, and he blames her for the 2011 demonstrations where hundreds of Russians took to the streets of Moscow and other cities to denounce his prolongation of his rule. He did apparently invite her. She asked him about the Siberian tigers and, whether he's really serious about conservation, and he invited her to come to Siberia with him. And for reasons I don't understand, she never took him up on that invitation, and that apparently irritated him. But, I just don't imagine that everything in Russia is governed by the mood of Vladimir Putin. So what's your sense of whether this whole story makes any sense at a basic level?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on Vladimir Putin and Russian politics in general. I mean, I know the same as the layperson, maybe a little bit more. My sense, based on what we're seeing in terms of tactics used by the attackers, and when you sort of triangulate that with other outside factors, like the ones that you mentioned, insofar as Putin has a track record of distrust and a little bit of vehemence towards Hillary Clinton, when you combine that with the types of attacks that we're seeing, the fingerprints left, I don't have an insight into what exactly the data flows look like, what exactly the exfiltration of data from the DNC servers and the path that data took, whether it went back to Russian servers in the hands of X, Y, and Z. I don't have insight into that. But when you begin to piece the different pieces of the puzzle together, it does look like a classic Russian-sponsored, if not Russian state, action. I'm inclined to trust the guys at CrowdStrike and elsewhere who are rather assuredly pointing the finger at the Russians.
Well, the one question that had always bothered me is that, as far as I know, we all know that the Hillary Clinton's private server has dogged her throughout this campaign, and she has many times said it's a terrible mistake, and I'm sure she regrets it more than anybody. But as far as I know, the existence of that server was broken by RT, Russia Today, based upon intercepts, based upon the hacking of Sidney Blumenthal's private email, and they were able to see that he was communicating with Hillary Clinton on this particular server, and that was back in March of 2013. If that's the case, then this whole election season, with what has been dogging Hillary Clinton, it would indicate that the Russians have been leading the American press and the Republicans by the nose.
So I think it's relatively safe to assume at this point that both Russian, Chinese, possibly Iranian, and a slew of other skilled nations are sitting on servers that host the private communications of not only our prospective presidential nominees or our presidential nominees from each of the major parties, but also probably the state and local election, candidates as well. The ease of entry into most of these email servers, it's so low and so simple for a skilled adversary to get in that intelligence services from the countries that I mentioned would be foolish not to do so. And I think it's you know, the United States most likely does the exact same thing. So, you know, I think they do have access to a lot of information that the American public doesn't, and how they then shape narratives in the American and non-American media comes down to sort of their information warfare strategies. And as we've seen with Russia in several parts of Eastern Europe, I'm thinking sort of Czech Republic, Estonia, amongst others, they're very adept at manipulating narratives to sort of fit their strategic goals. And it would not surprise me at all if they're trying the same types of things that they've done in those Eastern European countries in the U.S. now, just sort of at a more grandiose scale.
Well, this would suggest, though, if it's that easy for a relatively sophisticated state actor to do this kind of hacking and get this widespread and deep information on any and all politicians, then I imagine that our allies are probably more active in that than our adversaries.
Again, you know, it wouldn't surprise me. Many of our allies, and I think Israel at the top of the list, the Germans are also quite good, and as are many of, the UK and many other European states. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, when you think about it, especially when we're talking about a federal election, a presidential election, this is a leader that you're going to have to deal with, the leader of perhaps the predominant superpower, and you're going to have to deal with this person for the next 4, possibly 8 years. You'd want as much information as possible on that person to know exactly what you're getting into. I'd prefer not to think that they're looking for, leverage, so to speak, looking for dirt on the candidates, but really trying to get a sense of the personality and the type of person they're going to be dealing with, because, the president is, when it comes down to it, the end-all-be-all diplomat for the United States of America. And, you need to know the personality of the person across the table whenever you're negotiating with them. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Robert Morgus. I appreciate it.
Not a problem, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Morgus, who's a policy analyst with the New America Foundation Cybersecurity Initiative, where his work focuses on crisis management, international relations, and cyber risk and insurance. And in the past, he's authored reports on sanctions and export controls, internet freedom, and internet governance. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Federico Garcia and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.